from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In Isabel Allende's new novel, Maya's Notebook, the 19-year-old protagonist writes in journals about her happy childhood in Berkeley and her later escapades involving drugs, sex, and crime in Las Vegas as she hides out from her pursuers on an island off the coast of Chile. Allende will join us to talk about the book and about how she weaves her passion for her home country into her writing. She recently won the Carl Sandburg Literary Award, given to authors who have made significant contributions to the written word. Her other books include The House of Spirits, Of Love and Shadows, and The Infinite Plan. She joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. This hour, we're joined by Chile-born novelist Isabel Allende, who now lives in the Bay Area, and she's with us here in studio for the second hour, the author of 19 novels, which have been translated into 35 languages. She's a recipient of the Hans Christian Andersen Literature Award in 2012 for her children's books, and more recently, the Carl Sandburg Literary Award. Her newest book, about a 19-year-old Berkeley girl, is titled Maya's Notebook, and we welcome Isabel Allende back to Forum. I actually got a complaint that I have you on too much, but mi amiga especial, and it's just you produce too much.
That's, can never see too much of Michael Krasny.
You can never see too much of Isabel Allende. Congratulations, by the way, on the Sandburg Award. You could talk about that a little bit, because I keep thinking about him with the Hog Butchers of the World and Broad Shoulders, Chicago, and Abe Lincoln mainly.
It's a very prestigious award, and I am in very good company, so I feel very honored to have that award.
Well, and as well you should be. But then I'm thinking about also the Hans Christian Andersen Award. I wanted to mention that because that was for children's literature.
Oh, that was such a wonderful event. I went to Denmark, and the whole city of Odense, where Hans Christian Andersen was born, was... It was like a festival. The kids were dressed like the characters of his books, and there was a guy that dresses like him and goes around in the city on horseback. It's just gorgeous. And then I got to meet the prince and the royal family. It's very lovely.
Well, you take chances. I was thinking this before we go on the air. I mean, not only writing children's literature, adolescent literature, but now you've got a crime novel, which we want to talk about, perhaps, which is about to be come out in translation. And this novel about this 19-year-old girl, Maya's Notebook, which has just come out. I mean, to put yourself into the voice of a 19-year-old girl from Berkeley who has some serious problems, to put it mildly, that's pretty venturesome. That's bold.
You know, I wrote the book in 2010, and it took some time for the translation because my usual translator, Paige Peden, is 84, and she said that she could not get the voice of the young 19-year-old girl from Berkeley. And also she had an aneurysm, so we had to find another translator. That delayed the English publication. But at the time when I was writing the book, I was surrounded by teenagers. All my grandchildren were teenagers and their friends that were coming to our house to the pool and whatever. And I saw them and the parents, the struggle of the parents to keep them safe because they're exposed to so much in the world now. In the streets, alcohol, drugs, crime, violence. Through the internet, any pervert can approach them. There is porn. I mean, the things they see on the internet is incredible. They can even buy weapons if they want to. So
I saw them, but you also heard them.
I heard the voices, them constantly.
Yeah.
So the voice of Maya, the character of Maya, the adventures she goes through was very easy because I was seeing that around me all the time.
Well, the voice, it's funny. You know, at times early on, for example, when I started reading a novel, she says things that sound very much like a teenager. I'm single, but due to a lack of opportunities. Or she talks about the fact that when I'm trying to think of a few other things that she says that Attila the Hun would be a better name for me than Maya. These kinds of things, they're like a clever teenager, a bright teenager, which she is. And then when she starts talking about having telepathic Esperanto with her dog, that gave me a little bit of pause, I must admit.
Well, remember that she has a crazy grandmother that speaks like that. So she gets those ideas also from the grandmother. And when she talks about the stars, it's the grandfather talking. So this is a girl who has received...
The grandfather, we should mention, is an African-American astronomy professor at Berkeley. Uh-huh. And the grandmother, actually, especially when she starts thinking about her grandmother talking about houses having souls and spirits and everything, of course, I thought of you.
Well, I think that I modeled the grandmother on me because the grandmother is a tough broad who will slap the girl if she misbehaves, and at the same time, she would give her life for her.
Are you saying you countenance corporal punishment?
Of course. To my grandchildren, I slap them all the time.
Oh, this is going to you're going to get a lot of blowback on that. Yeah. I'm afraid, a lot of fire
but
on that.
They love me. They love me,
and you love them. But there are people who absolutely find it reprehensible, unacceptable to use any kind of physical punishment with a child.
Well, I'm not saying that I torture my grandchildren,
but even a slap, even what my parents used to call a potch, you know, a little hit or something. There are people who find that totally unacceptable.
I find it unacceptable to hit the dog, but the grandchildren.
All right. Now you hear the real philosophy of Isabella Allende. Actually, I got an email earlier from Elaine Petrocelli. Said, "I wonder what wise and humorous things you're going to hear from Isabella, and outrageous things." I think she said too, and that's one of the reasons I love having you back here. But let's talk about this new novel, and let's talk about. There's a lot of sadness in it. I mean,
yeah, a lot of loss.
She starts descending after her beloved step grandfather dies. But there's also addiction, and there's a rape, and you know there are gangsters, counterfeiters, and
yeah, I mean, she ends up homeless in Las Vegas.
And she's on the streets,
addicted.
Yeah.
I mean, starving.
It's
very
a grim,
ill.
Grim picture. In many
it's
ways.
A very grim picture of a descent into hell. Fortunately, it doesn't last very long because the grandmother steps in and rescues her just in time and sends him to this island in the southern part of Chile. And you've been there.
I've been there, thanks to you. I mean, you recommended it and I went, yeah.
Yeah, you know, people say, oh, it's like she goes to paradise. She doesn't go to paradise. The island has lousy weather to begin with, disconnected from everywhere, and it has incest, unemployment, domestic violence, rape also, all kinds of stuff.
A lot of potatoes and bread.
Yeah, yeah.
Although what I remember most of that island are the churches and...
The fish.
And the fish, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pescadores. I mean,
but if you can get into the houses and be with the people, especially in winter when there's nothing else to do, you hear the stories. The mythology of the island is fantastic and not contaminated by the Catholic Church.
Well, you also, I want to go back to the island, but you also sort of give Isabella Allende's view of Berkeley. And I just, in fact, if you want to read from Maya's notebook, you during the course of this hour, we'd be pleased to have you do that. But you say, I just wanted to actually give a little flavor about, especially for Berkeley listeners, and this may get some strong responses too, I'm not sure. I say, my Nini, that is her grandmother, felt right in her element in Berkeley, that gritty, radical, extravagant city with its mix of races and human pelts, with more geniuses and Nobel Prize winners than any other city on earth, saturated with noble causes, intolerant in its sanctimoniousness. That kind of says a lot of Berkeley, right? A friend of mine used to say Berkeley was like granola, you know, a lot of flakes and nuts and whatever.
And good for you.
And good for you, yeah. But you take us out on the streets and you take us to the island and you have a really wide canvas here again. But we're in that girl's mind. We're in her consciousness.
Yeah, because she's writing a diary. At the beginning of the book, the grandmother is taking her to the airport and she gives her a notebook, 100 pages. And she says, write down the stupid things you've done to see if you can come up to terms with the stupidities you've done. And so the girl, of course, is not willing to do that. But in Chiloé, in the island, she has nothing to do. She's disconnected from the world. For the first time in her life, she has time and silence.
She's also on the run. She's hiding.
She's hiding. That's why she can't be on the internet, twittering or emailing.
Hiding from a number of sources.
Yeah, the FBI, the police, the gangsters. couple of assassins that are after her. Everybody's after her.
And you take us also, I mean, we're talking about place here, to Vegas. And there are many writers who have tried to give us a sense of what it's like in Vegas. I'm thinking Joe Didion, John Gregory Dunn, Hunter Thompson. But you get into kind of the grittier world of Vegas. Everybody who writes about Vegas often writes about the Strip.
Yeah, but that's not all of it. She goes into the underworld. She goes into the world of prostitution and drugs and corrupt police and the stuff that is parallel to the glitter, and no one sees.
Where did you learn about that stuff? I mean, I know you do a lot of research, and I learned something I didn't even know about property ownership in Berkeley with racial exclusion until 1948. Those kinds of things, but. For example, did you go to Vegas?
Yeah, I've been in Las Vegas a couple of times.
To the non-glitter side?
I look for it. I look for it because if I need it for the book, that's what I have to look for.
Yeah. Well, the book again is called Maya's Notebook.
Michael, if I could research about the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago, give me a break. I can research about Berkeley and about Las Vegas.
No, I'm giving you all the breaks I can here. Are you kidding? By the way, we'll give you an opportunity to speak to Isabel. Did you want to read something from Maya's Notebook?
What?
Whatever you want, if you want to read. We can just keep conversing if you prefer.
Yeah, let's keep conversing until I make up my mind what to read.
All right. And by the way, Isabel Allende is speaking tonight at Dominican College at Angelica Hall.
Oh, yes,
Hall,
please come. Please
7
come.
P.M. She's also speaking this Thursday at UC Berkeley Center for Latin American Studies and at 6 p.m. at the law school. Once again, she's everywhere. How'd you get the this character, Lehman, Brandon Lehman, the counterfeiter? Where did he come from?
Actually, my son Jason Kirsten wrote a wonderful book about counterfeit money.
That's
he
right.
was in
yeah,
Forum,
yeah, yeah.
absolutely. Yeah. And I just plagiarized his book.
Well, the book, it's really
very simple.
All right, simple.
Stays in the family.
Simple answer. By the way, I saw an interview with you in the Sunday New York Times that I wanted to tell listeners about where. Well, you were talking about a number of things, even imagining what it would be like to have Zorro come into your boudoir, I guess.
I don't have a boudoir. I have a bed.
Yeah, I have a bed, which you said reading short stories and novels is as good as being between clean sheets and making love in that bed. I presume it would be in that bed. But also you talked about the erotic books or what was erotic to you as a childhood. And when you were talking about all the things that are available on the Internet now, I couldn't help suddenly remembering that and thinking about that because, you know, for us, there were thrills in particularly for you in Lebanon, that kids just, as you said, your grandchildren would have no interest in now or would not get any charge out of it all.
Not at all. But we lived in a world where everything that had to do with sex was secretive or forbidden. Or dangerous, or a sin. That was the best part. It was a sin. So naturally, it was very attractive.
And remained so.
Yeah. My first erotic experience was reading 1001 Nights, and today that would be for kindergarten kids.
And let's talk about the influences that kids come under today, because that's really a lot of what is congealed in this new novel of yours, that they're... especially if they start trying to find kicks or trying to find some way out of their feeling of grieving and loss and so forth. There's just so many things that can suck them in.
There's many dangers, and they are stimulated all the time. So there's luck. Some kids are lucky, and they make it safely. And some kids get involved with the wrong friends, start doing little things, smoking a little pot here, drinking a little bit there, and then things start to add up, and then they end up in deep trouble. And I've seen it, so I'm scared for them.
Can we talk about your loss, you and Willie's loss? I mean, do you feel okay talking about it?
I asked my husband if I could answer a few questions about this, and he agreed, and that's why we can talk about it. But my family is going through another big, awful tragedy. Like 3 weeks ago, my stepson, my youngest stepson, died of an overdose. And this is the second of Willie's children that dies with drug-related causes. Years ago, his daughter, Jennifer, died also. And so my husband is devastated and he's grieving. suddenly he looks 10 years older, and I can feel his grief inside me. Harley had a very difficult life, and still, the loss is unbearable, it's awful. Many years ago, when I wrote The Sum of Our Days, I interviewed Harley, and at that time he had been using, but he had just become clean. And all the information that he gave me, I used it in The Sum of Our Days. But then when the book was translated and I had a manuscript in English that he could read, I showed everybody who was mentioned in the book, I showed the manuscript to ask for their approval to be in the book or not. And Harley got really mad at me and said that he didn't want to be in the book, he didn't want to be portrayed as a drug addict. So I had to rewrite the book and take out 50 pages that were about Harley. And I destroyed those pages. I was furious. And then, years later, when I wrote Maya's Notebook, I did not have the 50 pages, but I had the story in my mind. So the only research I had to do was go out there and find out what the new drugs are all about. But the story is always the same. The story of addiction and the descent into hell is the same.
So it is in some ways Harley's story.
It is in some ways, of course. And there's one scene in this book that, to me, that Harley told me, and almost in his words, he had almost overdosed on heroin in a public bathroom, and he was dying. And he heard the voice of his sister, who was dead by then, the voice of his sister saying, "Breathe, Harley, breathe." And he saw her shoes there at the door of the bathroom. And he told me that story, and I totally believed that he saw his sister. His sister came to his help at that moment. And I have that scene in this book, in which Maya is dying, and the spirit of the grandfather comes and says, "Breathe, Maya, breathe."
Could be hallucination, but you think otherwise?
It could be anything. It could be memory, hallucination, the love for the person that is gone. It could be a ghost. Who knows? Who cares? The fact is that these things happen in the mind and in the heart of people.
Would you like Maya's Notebook to be read by young people?
Of course.
I mean, particularly as kind of a cautionary tale?
Not as a cautionary tale, because I'm not trying to preach or teach anything. I have questions, not answers. But for me, it's important to get in touch with the young people for whom this book was written. So now I'm using for the first time social media to really get that audience. Because young kids, you know,
Nico, your son is doing Twitter, isn't he?
Young kids don't read reviews. They don't listen to you. Of course they don't.
I would beg to differ to some degree. It sometimes amazes me how many demographics we seem to hit with this program.
I'm not trying to insult
you. No, I understand.
It was a joke.
Just don't slap me. That's talking to Isabel Allende. Her new novel is Maya's Notebook. And by the way, you can join us in conversation here. Lots to talk about, and many admirers of Isabel's work. But also, you may have some questions or some things to offer to the conversation in terms of this serious topic with respect to the descent that we see sometimes in young teenagers, and in fact, many times loved ones. If you'd like to join us, toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your phone calls with any questions or comments you might have. And I will, when she decides she wants to read something, have her read. Again, toll-free, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page, or post anything you have to say on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. Can I ask you about the vampires?
When Maya's grandfather dies and the grandmother goes into a depression and she feels abandoned, alone, she ends up with the wrong friends, with a couple of girls that are a disaster, the girls, and they call themselves the vampires. They are awful, and they get in all kinds of trouble: shoplifting, alcohol, drugs, and dealing drugs also.
You got into that sense of how important that peer approval is and how reckless these kind of young women, almost alpha women in some ways,
yeah,
can be.
Yeah. But I think that what is important to say is that Maya gets out of all that. This is a journey, and although she hits bottom, she's able to get out of it. And then there is the contrast between the life that she has had in Las Vegas and the life with those friends, the vampires, and then the other life that she will have in the island, which is not paradise, but it is.
But it's healing.
But it's healing,
yeah.
And it gives her what kids today don't have.
And if you
an opportunity to be in silence.
Well, but she also has people there who are caring for her and nurturing her. And what I realize, if I want to deconstruct your novel, I would say there's trouble in America, but there's healing in Chile.
Not really. No, not really. Yeah. I think that there is trouble in the island too, but at least there, because she's disconnected, she's not stimulated all the time. You know, American kids need to be entertained all the time. The idea that you have to be entertained, to me, is awful. Because then you have no blank spaces. There's no silence between the notes. Your mind is constantly boiling.
And how about entertaining yourself, too?
Yeah.
I mean, as opposed to looking for stimulation from external sources, which is really a lot of what we're talking about.
If you want, I found a place that I can read.
Well, hold off, because
yeah.
We're going to go to a break, and then we'll come back and we'll take calls. And unless, how long is it, roughly?
A minute and a half.
Do it.
Huh?
Yeah, do it. Go ahead.
My name is Maya Vidal. I'm 19 years old, female, single, due to lack of opportunities rather than by choice. I'm currently without a boyfriend. Born in Berkeley, California, I am a U.S. citizen and temporarily taking refuge on an island at the bottom of the world. They name me Maya because my nini has a soft spot for India, and my parents hadn't come up with any other name, even though they had 9 months to think about it. In Hindi, Maya means charm, illusion, dream, nothing to do with my personality. Attila would suit me better, because wherever I step, no pasture will ever grow again. My story begins in Chile with my grandmother, my nini, a long time before I was born, because if she hadn't emigrated, she would have never fallen in love with my popo or moved to California. My father would have never met my mother, and I wouldn't be me, by rather a very different Chilean girl. What do I look like? I'm 5 feet 10, 128 pounds when I play soccer, and several more if I don't watch out. I've got muscular legs, clumsy hands, blue eyes or gray, depending on the time of the day, and blonde hair, I think, but I'm not sure, since I haven't seen my natural hair color for quite a few years now.
Good way to introduce your character. Have her describe herself in a notebook. Vidal, the name? You know, I think I've got Gore Vidal or...
It's a very Chilean name, by the way.
It is a Chilean
name.
Yeah,
very, very Chilean.
Well, and another Chilean novel in many respects. Did you see No, the movie? You did, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. I did. I liked it very much.
Yeah, so did I. And if it's still around, I would recommend it, in fact. It's about the plebiscite that took place that essentially led to the removal
in 1988.
It did lead eventually to the removal of Pinochet. We're going to continue our conversation with Isabel Allende and the Carl Sandburg recipient, literary award winner, and you can join us by emailing forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest, the wife of Willie who? Oh, I just had to do that. Willie Gordon, Isabel's husband, always says to me, she's very famous internationally, goes with her to all these places where they give her great tribute and honor, and he'll say, Willie who? And he writes novels. He's, in fact, been on forum talking about his novels. Isabel will be speaking tonight, 7 p.m. at Dominican University's Angelico Hall, and on Thursday, 6 p.m. at the Booth Auditorium at UC Berkeley School of Law, and advance tickets are sold out, so there may be tickets available at the door. Boy, you're still a big magnet.
You know, that won't last. I just read Nathan Engelland's book, and there's a story there called The Reader.
Yes.
I photocopied it, and I have it on my computer, next to my computer. It's the story of a best-selling author that 10 years later, no one buys his books and goes in a book tour all by himself, driving his car, and no one shows up at the readings.
Trust me,
my future.
It's not going to happen to you.
Oh, yes.
But I like the fact that you have that humility to think that that's your future. So you read Englander. What did you think of him?
I loved him.
Yeah. He's good. He's been on forum a few times, a number of times, in fact.
Some of the stories are so memorable.
Yeah. And you've written another book called Ripper, again, taking chances, writing books about Zorro, writing books about Berkeley, teenagers on the run and all that. And this is another one which will be coming out. This is obviously great fun for you to have written.
Yeah, it's a thriller. It's a crime novel, and it happens in San Francisco in 2012.
I look forward to that. And we'll go to some calls here in just a moment. Wanted also to talk about something really very serious that you deal with in this in Maya's notebook, the new novel. And that's a rape. A young woman hitchhiking, you know, out on her own.
In the middle of the woods in Oregon.
Truck driver comes by and figures he's predatory and fair game. Yeah,
fair game. And there's a whole culture of kids that do prostitution to survive and to do drugs. And you know that when a child runs away from home, according to the statistics, in less of 48 hours, he or she will be approached for sex.
Either there are pimps who are waiting at the Greyhound bus stations in big cities.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that risk is always there.
But it's also the brutality of rape, of course, that is a risk that they're constantly vulnerable to.
Yeah. It's amazing what people who have not experienced rape cannot imagine that it is an act of extreme violence. It has nothing to do with desire or with love or with relationship or connection or anything. It's just violence.
Let's bring our callers in, and we begin with Fernando. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Isabel.
Hola.
Hola, ¿cómo estás? I went to Cal in the 60s, and I think you were there. I have been to Chiloé many times. I have children born in Berkeley, so the theme today is quite relevant to my existence. And I have a question for you. Can you make any parallels, any comparisons, or what guidelines do you see in the current mode in the Chilean youth, the country you were from? What do you see there that compares to our country here in the United States?
You know, I see that it's very similar. The American culture has invaded the world, and kids all over the world are listening to the same music, and they are Twittering and using the internet in the same way. I think that the only thing that could be different is that usually kids in other countries, in Chile, I can only talk about Chile, have a very solid, extended family structure. They are not so lonely as they are here. So they have to respond to people of several generations. They live with grandparents, with babies, with neighbors, with uncles. So there's a larger structure to hold them. I have seen my son trying to raise three teenagers. He lost all his hair, just with the GPS, trying to follow them on the phone.
Yeah.
He went crazy trying to keep them safe. And in other places, there are more people that can help.
Now, what about the role of the church in Chile? I mean, it's declined, of course, but it's still strong, isn't it?
It's very strong. People are very religious in Chile. And sometimes kids get involved in church things that save them and keep them safe for as long as needed.
And Fernando, you are from Chile, yeah?
I feel that, yes, I am. I feel that it's an anonymity here in the U.S., which in Chile is very hard to maintain. Children belong to a family,
yeah.
Belong to friends, belong to a school. They belong, in other words. They're not alone. And the social mores and the social pressures and social controls are still strong, although I can see the trend that you say, Isabel.
Yeah.
There is a little trend of emulation to the U.S. modes, but not as strong, I would say, and perhaps they have a little healthier outlook.
I don't know if it's healthier, but it certainly makes you connected and responsible. You have a sense of honor, of the family honor, that, and everybody's watching. So yes, it's harder to get away with stuff.
As more of an extended family, too.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But I see them fighting in the streets for free education, for public health.
Mm-hmm.
In America, our youth is totally not interested, even though they're suffering from all the social things that we know about. I think the Chileans are really involved in their political process, Mrs. Bachelet going back and various other issues.
Yeah, they're very politicized, but not everybody. Not everybody, yeah?
No, clearly not. No, but I think it's a big bot there that drives some, which I don't see here. So alienation really leads you to drugs and various other things, gang memberships and such, which there is not as strong.
Well, Fernando, thank you for those for the question and those comments that you've provided. I appreciate hearing from you, and I want to go to another caller here. Kay, join us. Hi.
Hello, Isabel. My condolences to you for the loss of your stepson.
Thank you.
As a mother and a stepmother myself, my heart is completely with you.
Thank you.
I was curious if you had seen the film called No, about the referendum on Pinochet.
I just asked her that. You tuned in a little later, Kay, but she said she liked it. I liked it. What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was great. I was also curious to see if we could look forward to any more film adaptations of any of Isabel's books.
Well, my last experience with Hollywood wasn't that good. I spent like a fortune in lawyers and 4 years discussing contracts for Daughter of Fortune. And at the end, I could not sign the contract because they wanted the rights to do anything they wanted forever in the universe and other universes to be discovered. I'm not kidding. This is
you would have had car
contract.
Crashes in the Daughter of Fortune.
Yeah, and then they want the copyright of the characters. So if I use my characters in another novel, I have to pay them a royalty. So I can't sign that kind of contract.
See, it's good to be married to a lawyer.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call, Kay. And by the way, again, you can
join. No, but there are a couple of movies that are coming out. Zorro, they're making the movie. And The City of the Beasts, the first volume of my trilogy for kids. So things are moving a little. But the good news is that there is an opera with Placido Domingo in Los Angeles, I think it's by the middle of May, the premiere.
Now, I have to watch myself with my language here, but I remember Placido Domingo, a story, calling you, and your assistant answered the phone. I think it was your relative, in fact, at the time. And he said his name or something, and she let out an expletive. I mean, she just couldn't believe it was Placido Domingo. It's Francis who writes, thank you for the opportunity to listen to her voice. It is rhythmic and intriguing, as is her writing. I recently read The Island Beneath the Sea and was again entranced by her storytelling. I can't wait to read Maya's notebook. We are fortunate to have Ms. Allende in our lives.
Thank you so much. I need more readers like you.
And we'll have more callers. Susan, good morning.
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to call. I heard you speak a long time ago in San Francisco, Miss Allende.
Thank you.
And I'm a woman around your age. I have granddaughters and grandsons. And what do you attribute your resilience to? So many women that have experienced a similar distressing and heartbreaking become bitter or apathetic or just check out or, I don't know, how do you do it? What do you attribute that resilience to, that wonderful spirit resilience?
You know, people think that I have had a hard life. My heart is my life is not harder than anybody else's. I've been very lucky in my life, and I have had losses like everybody, but also success and love and friendship and opportunities. I've seen the world. I'm very lucky. I don't feel that in any way I have had a harder life than anybody else.
But there is something about your spirit that at least friends of yours, like I believe I am, I can comment on. And there is a resiliency. There is an energy and a kind of attitude toward life that's quite healthy and in its way loving, really.
Thank you. That's due
that
to...
serves you. That
yeah,
serves
well,
you.
I eat a lot of dark chocolate. It helps a lot.
And she brought some for me. Is this a new enterprise?
Yeah.
Is it a picture of Isabel with spirit and spice, dark chocolate. I've said this on the air before, and I hate to admit it to you, but I prefer milk chocolate. I'm just not a dark chocolate guy.
Well, then you are not really an addict.
Can we still be friends? Never a chocolate-holic, but certainly not dark chocolate. And it's probably because it's healthier. Tom, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
What you and Isabel said earlier about memory and hallucination kind of triggered in my mind my own a struggle recently with memory because of suffering a personal loss of a loved one over a year and a half ago. And I still revisit her presence every night, you know, through my memory. And I realize that she is all in my mind and my soul. But what you said about your nephew being visited by his sister.
Her stepson, sorry.
The stepson, excuse me. And that perhaps she was never there and it's a hallucination. Whether she was there or not, in reality, it's for me, besides the point, I think souls live inside our
own souls. Carry them.
And we carry them. And I think Harley could very well have experienced her in his mind. Mm-hmm. And that's how memory, I think, is important. And that's how we see ourselves and experience ourselves in our memory. And what makes us human beings, our sense of self and identity. And on a larger societal level, it made me think about how collectively, a lot of us immigrants, I'm from Burma originally, Rangoon, and a lot of our acculturation process, you know, becoming American, so to speak, experiences a lot of loss of our memory and cultural identity.
Yeah.
And we hang on to a lot of things from our childhood that we still won't let go and won't forget.
Tom, I'm struck by your comments, particularly in terms of, I'm raising, I know, a big metaphysical question here, but you obviously believe, like Tom, that we have a soul. Why?
Oh, because I have evidence of it. My daughter died years ago, and like Tom says, I carry her with me. The soul, like love and like so many other things, you have to experience them to know them. It's very hard to describe something that is not physical, that cannot be described with our senses, that is something that you experience in meditation. I don't know if you are a religious person. I know you are not because I read your book. But and I'm not a religious person either. I don't belong to any church. But I do believe that there's much more than what we perceive with our senses.
There's the metaphysical, beyond the physical.
Of course, and there's so much we don't know. Life and the world are so mysterious, and we think we understand everything. We think that we can own everything, sell everything, explain everything, control everything. Well, no, there's so much that is mysterious, and I know that in some place, there's the spirit of my daughter and the spirit of Harley and Tom's beloved person that died. I don't know. I feel that the boundaries between death and life are so flimsy, so flimsy.
Our guest again is Isabel Allende, her new book, Maya's Notebook, and our next caller, Anthony. Good morning.
Good morning. Isabel.
Yes.
So nice to hear you. We actually know each other from Omega. I'm the guy that does flowers, or used to do flowers there.
Oh, how are you?
It's so nice to hear you. I wanted you to just talk a little bit about the things that are going. It's always been, historically, there's been these atrocities towards women. And you know all the things that are happening in India and around the world now. What do you think is going on? I mean, it's like this... It's combusting it.
No, it's just that we know more. This has always been like this, and worse, way worse. But now we are informed. Something happens to a girl in India, and in 2 seconds, it's all around the world, and people can react because we are connected and we are informed. But when I was growing up, these things were happening in a larger scale, and we had no idea, and we had no way of reacting either. It has taken many, many years of feminism for women in the world to be aware that they can complain.
Thank you, Anthony, for that call. Actually, when you were talking before the soul, I was thinking of early on in the book when Maya's describing her grandmother, who you said you have some connection to or attachment to as a character, and you She says of her grandmother, she thinks jet travel is not advisable because the soul travels more slowly than the body, falls behind, and sometimes gets lost along the way.
That happens to me in the book tours. When I get back
from a book tour. How do you fly so much then? Because you
I get back from a book tour and I have to retrieve my soul from, I don't know, from Massachusetts or someplace.
And how much of your soul is still in Chile?
Half of it. Half is here and half is in Chile.
You know, you once wrote a book that we talked about on the air about Chilean humor.
Which is very much like Jewish humor.
We've had that conversation, and I think that is indeed the case. But I'm also struck by the fact that you've had a lot of material just living in the Bay Area, especially living in Marin County, for your own creation of humor. I mean, you know, some very funny lines about life in Marin County.
Yeah, I remember when I moved to Marin County following a man that I had fallen in lust with, Willie Hu. And I said, Willie, how come that there at 11 o'clock in the morning, there are all these guys sitting there in coffee shops? And he said, they're all therapists. That's Marin County for me.
That's also a very good line. Now, let's talk about this relationship and again, how it's working, because Willie has taken on the mantle of being pretty much a full-time writer now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's now writing his sixth crime novel. They're all placed in 1960, around the 60s, in San Francisco. And he's doing well. He's going to Brazil tomorrow.
He's translated now in many
languages. He's translated,
yeah.
And he's going to Brazil, where he has some following, and then he will go to Argentina. They're also in Spanish, his novels.
He's got a lot of catching up to do with you. How many? What do you get? 57 million copies of Isabella.
That was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, so you're ahead of that now.
I hope
that was the last
figure
I had.
Yeah, I hope I'm ahead of that.
That's peanuts. That's piker's fee, as we used to call it. I mean, you know, when you first set out on this journey, thinking, well, if Gabriel Garcia Marquez can tell these stories, I can probably tell. I mean, you were a journalist, and I think, wasn't it Neruda who said to you...
that I was a lousy journalist.
You shouldn't be a journalist. You should be a fiction writer. You took it literally. I mean, who... Again, you talk about your good fortune and luck and everything, but to have reached the sort of level internationally that you've reached is extraordinary. I mean, how many writers can...
Well, that's why I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall, you know, and then just fall on my face.
That's the tragedian pessimist in you, but...
Yeah.
You know, you've had to deal with so many losses that I think, you know, those kind of human losses overshadow any kind of loss from fame or from success or anything of that sort. And you're not going to have that loss, I don't think. But what's next after Ripper?
A love story. I already started it.
On the same January date that you started,
yes,
everything else?
On January 8th.
Maybe I won't ask anything more than that. But, you know, it was obviously percolating and... It was embryonic in you even when you were doing these other books?
No, this is a story. This never happens to me. I was walking in New York in the street with a friend, and she started telling me the story of her mother. And it was an extraordinary story. And I said, can I write? And she said, yeah, you want to meet my mother? So I went and I talked to her mother. She gave me pictures and stuff, and I'm going to write about it. Hmm. I mean, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to research.
And this is an American woman?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so the story took off even more from talking with the mother?
Yes, but I don't need to talk too much because I need my imagination. If I have too much information, then I will stick to the truth, and that doesn't work in
you
fiction.
You become a journalist.
Yeah, it doesn't work. You have to lie.
Yeah, well, that's what fiction is. You also talked to a number of young women before you did Maya's Notebook or in the process. You went to Berkeley, actually, didn't you?
I went to Berkeley, and we spent a couple of days with... kids from Berkeley High, a wonderful high school, by the way. I mean, it's huge, like, I don't know, more than 3,000 kids. And you see everything there, from all colors, all styles, but they're all kids. And it's a wonderful place.
But it's a very unusual high school because you have this mixture of classes and ethnicities that you almost find nowhere.
And some kids fall through the loops and they through the cracks, and then they don't make it. But some make it to the highest, high education in this country, to the best education. So it's a very good place.
I know you don't like to be didactic in your work, but let me ask you to be didactic outside of your work for a moment. What advice would you have for parents who, you know, have children like Maya, who see the kids coming under bad influences or possibly going into a life of addiction? I mean, you've been through such hell.
Oh, my dear, I wish I had an advice. Willie and I started dealing with this when Harley was really young. He was around 10. And we didn't know what to do. We got advice from all kinds of people, from counselors, educators, psychiatrists, all kinds of people. Finally, he ended up in a school in Oregon, like the school where Maya is sent. And they kept him safe for 3 years there. But then when he came out, he was lost again. So I don't have advice because, for me, nothing worked.
No wisdom that you could, even looking backward, we could have done this differently or we could have done this
whatever
instead,
we would have done, I don't know if it would have worked.
Here's a listener named Tom who says, love your writings. I was arrested and escaped from prison in Chile in 1976. Eventually, wow. I returned to California. The military sent an assassin after me. Many people in the States today find this too unbelievable, knowing the mentality of the Chilean military at the time. Would you have thought this inconceivable? The story was produced by the National Geographic Channel on Locked Up Aboard Chile Prison Break, although time restrictions ended the story before I returned to California.
Of course that could have happened. The military had Letelier killed in Washington. He was driving his car with his American secretary and they blew up the car. So if that can, and they killed people in Italy, they've killed people everywhere.
Who was that, I'm going blank on his name, unfortunately, the Chilean author who they also tried to assassinate in Washington, who had fled from Chile, who I'm trying to think of.
Dorfman?
Yeah.
Ariel Dorfman.
Yeah, Ariel Dorfman. Another caller joining us. Holisa, hi, good morning.
Hi, I'm really so excited to hear you talk, and I am 42 years old, and I'm fascinated with your book. So I want to thank you for transporting me to those stories, but all those details that you write, and I just feel inside those stories like I'm living them, and I want to thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to ask you, when you were little, when did you start writing? I mean, were you really an avid reader when you were little? I have a 7-year-old daughter, and she loves to read. And so I'm just curious.
When I was little, there was no television in Chile. We never went to the movies. I mean, either you read or there was nothing else to do. And so I was a good reader, and I was a good student too, but I didn't start writing fiction until I was almost 40. I had to support a family. And I didn't know if I could make it writing books.
But you took the leap.
No, I didn't take the leap. I'm glad that you started writing because I don't know how could we miss out on your stories if you didn't start writing.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Emily writes, I'm very excited to hear about your new book. I have long wished you would write a book about Juana Briones, who was a pioneer settler in San Francisco. She seems like a woman whose story is fascinating. You would write her story beautifully. I'm here to beg. Please, 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 and thank you for your amazing body of work. Juana Briones apparently raised 7 kids plus an orphan girl and became a pioneer settler at Yerba Buena.
In Yerba Buena. Well, I wrote a book about the gold rush and about the first people who came to the gold rush from abroad. And it was a fascinating research. And that is one of the books that several times I have had offers to make the movie.
That's Daughter of Fortune again. Yeah.
Yeah.
A web comment from Anna. Isabel Allende, excuse me, is one of my favorite authors. Please ask her where she finds the inspiration to write about magical places that transport the reader. Her book, Island Beneath the Sea, was a delightful read. Isabel es un orgullo hispano.
Orgullo hispano. Thank you very much. The inspiration, I never know from where it comes. I wasn't planning to write a book about Haiti. I was planning to write about a book about the pirates of the Caribbean, set in New Orleans. So when I started researching the history of that city, I realized that all the French flavor and the voodoo and the cuisine and much of its wonderful, wonderful cultural background comes from 10,000 French immigrants that came in 1800 to New Orleans. That was a very small town at the time. And these 10,000 people were running away from the revolt in what was then called Saint-Domingue and later became Haiti. So I said, why were they running away? From what were they running away? And looking at the history, I realized that that was much more interesting than the Pirates of the Caribbean.
It's interesting. A lot of writers will say, when I sit down and have another novel, even if it's schematic in my mind or I have a question or an image or something that's got catalyst force behind it, I don't know if I'm going to have enough to make the long run. I don't know that I'm going to be able to marshal my resources to get to the end of this book and do the whole book and so forth. But with you, it seems different to me. Now, maybe you can disabuse me of that, but it seems as if you get an idea in your mind and then you're off and running.
Yes. With a historical novel, it's easy because once you start researching, the research gives you almost everything. You never expect the things to have happened that way, places to be so crazy, people doing such awful things. You can never imagine it.
So, I've had writers also tell me, by the way, the research is more fun.
I don't know if it's more fun, but it gives you everything.
But they have to sit down and do the writing, and that's more.
that's the terrible part.
This was at the Logan Symposium in Berkeley. I asked Adam Hochschild, who loved doing all that research about his book on World War I. I said, "What about the writing?" "No, that's torture." But I just wish I could have kept doing the research over and over and over again. But something ignites in you, and you're off.
Yeah. But often there people who write that kind of book research on one theme, and they become wonderful specialists in just World War I. I can't do that.
No, because you're Catholic in every sense of the word.
No.
I mean, Catholic in the universal way. I mean, you have to try different things and do different things.
I get bored. Once I'm done with the slaves in Haiti, goodbye. I don't want to think about them anymore.
We've just found the answer to what to do with teenagers. I mean, particularly keeping them away from difficulties. Keep them from being bored with things that occupy their mind and insist on the idea that they be engaged by those things.
Uh-huh.
If you can ignite that, it can relieve a lot of suffering, I think. I don't know. I'm being didactic here, but I may have come up with something. And again, always good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Michael.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.